Welcome to Gulf War, the battle after the war. So I attended the RAC meeting yesterday via phone. That's the Research Advisory Committee by Veteran Affairs. And there were some interesting talking points. Most of it was in relation to COVID and how it affects Gulf War vets in particular, but their comment pretty much was, nobody is really sure how, not how, but I guess if COVID will affect us more readily than the general population or other veterans. I tend to stick with the common sense theory that since it seems to be mostly respiratory and seems to cause blood clots and all kinds of issues in that respect, I would say, based on what I know of Gulf War illness to be, it's probably something that's going to be a little bit more dangerous for us than your general population. So that being the case, I would say, and this is just my opinion based on common sense, not any kind of really medical certification of any sort, just be careful. If you go out, obviously wear the mask. It's not to necessarily protect you, to protect others. I mean, it does protect you as long as you're using it correctly. There's YouTube videos out there that show you how to properly use a mask in case you don't know. Some fundamentals are, once you put it on, don't play with it. Leave it on your face until you're out of wherever you're at, and then you can take it off using one hand and put it down. Obviously, if it's on your face and you're touching your face, then the mask is doing you no good. So that's my rant on masks. The other thing that they discussed was PTSD, which was kind of interesting. The medications that they had listed there were still fairly old. One of the two that were listed there was gabapentin, and the other one was fluoxetine. If you listen to any of my earlier casts about medications that were prescribed to me early on that were supposedly supposed to be helpful for PTSD and depression, my gabapentin experience, and in short, 2 days into that medication, I believe, might even been the first day, I got up that night to go to the bathroom and walked into the bedroom window. So they took me off that one. And fluoxetine was the next one that they tried, I believe. And that one caused hypokalemia, which is basically dumps all the potassium out of your body, which is not good for your heart. So those were my experiences with dealing with medications prescribed for PTSD. So obviously I didn't give that a third chance. I decided to go it on my own. I'm not saying that's the right answer, but that was the right answer for me. And the other thing that I found interesting, there was a doctor who was speaking about ketamine treatment. And I have heard the word in passing. I don't know where or remember the conversations that I had about ketamine. I know it's been around for a while, and I did some digging, and it looks like it goes back as far as 1968, maybe a little further, and they used it for the Vietnam vets to help with depression. And I thought it was kind of interesting when they were talking about it yesterday. It seems like it's something that's coming back into study, and they seem to be having some success with it. Unlike cannabis or cannabidiol, I know they're using that as well, and that was mentioned yesterday too, but very briefly. And I had actually asked questions about the two, and really the only answer that I was able to glean as far as difference between the two is cannabidiol is done with a pill form, and the ketamine treatment is actually intravenous. So they stick a needle in you and monitor you and do it that way. And I believe there was multiple treatments. I heard the doctor mention, I believe it was three times a week, or three times in the first week, three times in the second week, and it gives you X amount of time and benefit. But when I asked the questions, I was sent an article later from Denise. I appreciate that, Denise. It's actually quite interesting. I'm going to read it to you because it kind of explains a little bit about what they've done as far as the study goes. The introduction starts out as it is estimated that approximately 25% to 33% of the nearly 700,000 U.S. soldiers deployed during the 1991 Gulf War suffer from a chronic multi-symptom disorder known as Gulf War illness. Gulf War and health deployment complexities led to exposure to a cocktail of chemicals and environmental factors in the Iraqi war theater, and is thought to underlie the multifactorial nature of Gulf War illness development in Gulf War veterans. Exposure to organophosphates, or OP as it abbreviated, compounds that includes commonly used pesticides and lethal nerve agents is documented during the first Gulf War and has strongly been implicated as one of the leading causes for Gulf War illness. Recent studies have shown that mood disorders, including major depression, are more prevalent in deployed first Gulf War veterans than non-deployed soldiers. Treatment with conventional antidepressants is limited by a delay of weeks for the onset of therapeutic effects, and many patients do not achieve sustained remission of depressive symptoms. So what they're saying at this point is the antidepressant drugs that they were prescribing, much like the two that I mentioned, take several weeks in order to start showing some form of improvement or start to feel like there's some form of improvement. Whereas ketamine seems to be a quick response within a few hours. I'll keep reading and you'll see. Ketamine is being put forward as capable of producing a rapid onset and sustained antidepressant response. Multiple preclinical studies have reported on antidepressant effects of ketamine in various rodent models of depression, and novel mechanisms for its actions have been uncovered. Recently, the United States Food and Drug Administration approved a nasal spray of ketamine, and I've read this a couple times now and I still can't pronounce it, enantiomer of ketamine for treatment resistant depression. However, there is no evidence whether ketamine is effective in treating GWI depression. Using a repeated low dose exposure to an OP agent, diisopropyl fluorophosphate, or DFP, in rats, we observed development of chronic depression, memory impairment, and hippocampal injury similar to those reported in GWI veterans. This rat model mimics one aspect of the multifactorial etiology of GWI disorder and could be useful for the study of some of the other GWI symptoms. Subsequently, we also reported chronic elevations in second messenger calcium levels and hippocampal neurons isolated from the DFP-exposed GWI-like rats. Ketamine exhibits pleiotropic actions, including being an inhibitor of the N-methyl diaspartate receptor channel complex and a strong promoter of brain-derived neurotropic factor mechanisms in the brain. In this study, we investigated molecular mechanisms for the possible antidepressant-like effects of ketamine in a GWI depression phenotype following DFP exposures. Our results demonstrate that in a rat model of DFP-induced depression, inhibition of the NMDAR calcium pathway is involved in the rapid onset antidepressant effects of ketamine, while the antidepressant actions that persisted 24 hours post-ketamine administration involved upregulation of BDNF signaling. And then they go on to talk about the materials and methods. I'm not going to read through that because it's really just talking about the animals. Uh, DFP exposure. Rats were injected with DFP once daily for 5 days, while control rats received DFP vehicle injections, phosphate buffered saline, for the same period. Animal health, including weight measurements, were assessed daily during the exposure for all additional 7 days following DFP injections. No overt cholinergic signs such as seizures were observed during DFP administrations or subsequently after the end of the treatment period. Now, as I get into this, I'm going to tell you ahead of time, I would rate this cast at this point at least a PG-13, so you understand that you're probably going to have to explain certain things to children that you may not want to at this point. So if you want to pause this cast right here and continue it later when you can listen, I would do that now. The experimental design at 3 months following DFP exposures, no significant differences in weights or any overt cholinergic symptoms were observed between control and DFP exposed rats. At this time, point post DFP exposure rats were separated into three groups. Group 1, assessment of the effects of ket or ketamine and MEM enforced swim test. Separate cohort of rats were used for various dose and time points. And then group 2, neuronal ratiometric CA2 measurements in ket and MEM treated rats. And then in group 3, Western blot analysis on hippocampal homogenates obtained from ket and MEM treated rats. Each animal was tested only once and one test at one drug dose. Animals were randomized into various groups and subgroups using a randomization software. Behavioral outcomes in rats are significantly affected by motor activity, be it the swimming behavior or maze exploration or drug discrimination. We relied on the open field test performance to determine whether to move forward with forced swim test or not for a given dose of ketamine or MEM. The decision to test a later time point was dependent on whether significant effects were observed at an earlier time point on the forced swim test. 9-week-old male Sprague Dolly rats were exposed once daily to OP agent DFP or vehicle. Let's see, about 3 months later, DFP rats and age-matched vehicle control rats were treated with various doses of either saline, ketamine, or memantine, and assessed for an in vivo or in vitro effect at 1 hour or 24 hours. Post-injection as follows. Group 1, assessment of the effects of ketamine and memantine enforced swim test. Separate cohort of rats were used for various dose and time points. In group 2, ket and MEM treated rats were euthanized. Calcium 1 hippocampal neurons acutely isolated and immediately subjected to CA2 imaging studies. And group 3, ket and MEM rats were euthanized, hippocampal homogenates obtained, and subjected to antibody-specific Western blot analysis. And then the open field test was used to assess effect on drug treatment on general activity levels and gross locomotor activity. Briefly, rats were placed in a black perspex box 90 centimeters by 60 centimeters by 50 inches in a quiet, dimly illuminated room for 10 minutes. Distance traveled during the exploration period was automatically assessed using an overhead camera and a video tracking system. The arena was cleaned with a 70% ethanol solution and dried completely in between each subject to eliminate any potential odor cues. The forced swim test was used to assess behavioral despair. Briefly, animals were placed in a glass cylindrical chamber, 46 centimeters by 30 centimeters, filled with water, and that was 30 centimeters high with 25 degrees Celsius, and forced to swim for 6 minutes. Swimming sessions were recorded for offline analysis. Active swimming, climbing, diving, and passive immobility behavior was evaluated by two reviewers blinded to the treatment conditions. Immobility primary outcome was defined as the period during which the animal floats in the water, making only those movements necessary to keep its head above water. The tank was emptied and thoroughly cleaned between sessions. Acute isolation of CA1 hippocampal neurons was performed as described previously. And briefly, rats were anesthetized, decapitated, and brains rapidly dissected. Hippocampal slices were cut on a vibrating microtome and treated with 8 milligrams protease solution. CA1 hippocampal region was excised and triturated with a series of pasture pipettes of decreasing diameter and cold 4 degree Celsius solution containing, not sure what, in vitro gen. The cell suspension was placed in two well glass bottom chambers. Previously treated poly-L-lysine and CellTac for better adherence. Following the incubation period, Fura-2-loaded cells were transferred to a 37 degrees Celsius heated stage on an Olympus IX70 inverted microscope coupled to a fluorescence imaging system. All image acquisition and processing were controlled by a computer connected to the camera and filter wheel using Metaflour software. We performed calcium or CA2 collaboration determinations as described previously. And that was to provide estimates of absolute CA2 concentrations from 340 to 380 ratio values. The Western blot studies, rats were deeply anesthetized under saturated isoflurane conditions and then euthanized by decapitation. Brains were immediately removed and placed on glass surface, cooled over ice. The hippocampus was dissected out and flash frozen in liquid nitrogen and stored at 80 degrees Celsius until use. 10 milligrams of hippocampus was homogenized with radioimmunoprecipitation assay and ALT protease inhibitor buffer. The homogenate was centrifuged at 14,000 RPMs at 4 degrees Celsius for 10 minutes. Total protein concentration was measured using these words are horrible bisynconic acid or BCA of total protein, and I think that's 20, I don't know what UL stands for, I don't remember, 20 UL of BME. Buffer were separated on gradient 4 by 20% sodium dodecyl sulfate. Oh, and there's more. Polyacrylamide gel. Electrophoresis. They're killing me here. Gels. By electrophoresis for 45 minutes at 200 volts and 230 milliamps. And then transferred on to polyvinylidene difluoride, or PVDF. I wish they'd just put the abbreviations at the beginning. The membranes were blocked in 5% milk and tris-buffered saline with 0.1% tween, 20 TBST for 1 hour. The blots were cut between the BDNF and, glycerol, glyceraldehyde? That's not even a word I've heard of. 3-phosphate dehydrogenase bands after locating them visually, visual standard ladder, and using stain-free images of the blots unstained ladder. Now, just in case y'all are wondering, I do read through these articles like 3 or 4 times before I record them for you. And I do look up these words, but with my short-term memory issues, I don't retain any new information. So we may go back through this, and trying to read these words is ridiculous. But anyway, the BDNF section was probed using primary BDNF antibody at 1 to 1,000. While the GAPDH section was probed with 1 to 5,000 MA515738 thermoscientific, both at 4 degrees Celsius overnight, followed by 3 TBST washes for 5 minutes each. The BDNF blot was incubated with horseradish peroxidase, coupled rabbit IgG secondary antibody 1 to 10,000 707-4S cell signaling, while the GAPDH blot was incubated with HRP-coupled mouse IgG secondary antibody 1 to 20,000 707-6S cell signaling, both for 1 hour at room temperature. Blots were washed 5 times TBST for 5 minutes. Blots were treated with 2UL Clarity, Western Enhanced, chemiluminescence or ECL substrate, 170-5060 Biorad, Hercules, California. I think that's the site and where it was done. To start chemiluminescence and imaged 5 minutes afterwards. Denise, you should be on this cast with me to help me with these words. The two pieces of a blot were realigned and imaged at the default auto optimal exposure setting or manual exposure setting up to 5 minutes, acquiring an image each 10 seconds in a ChemiDoc Touch or Biorad. Images were analyzed using ImageLab. The intensity levels of BDNF were normalized to the reference bands of GAPDH to yield a normalization factor used to calculate the normalized intensity for BDNF bands of each sample. Rats used to obtain hippocampal specimen for Western blot experiments were not previously subjected to FST. Data analysis and graphs plotted using the Sigma Plot 14 software. A student's test was used for CA2 comparisons. Disassociating the hippocampal slices routinely yielded 20 to 25 healthy phase bright neurons that were used for the recordings. The means of each group of neurons from each animal were used to evaluate results and conduct statistical analysis. Data from each animal were pooled together in respective groups and ultimately represented as total number of cells studied. For measuring changes in protein levels, relative optical densities for the specific protein bands were measured, corrected for protein loading against GAPDH, and then calculated as a ratio of control or SEM. To compare optical densities between control and DFP rats, a student's T-test was used. To compare optical densities between DFP rats treated with saline or KET or MEM, a one-way analysis of variance, ANOVA, followed by a post hoc turkey test was used. I'm sorry, not turkey. Tukey test. Tukey. For behavioral analysis, we used a one-way ANOVA followed by a post hoc test such as Tukey or Dunnett's, wherever appropriate. In all cases, statistical significance was indicated. The results, effects of KET and MIM on FST behavior in DFP rats. Our previous studies demonstrated chronic depression-like symptoms in DFP-exposed rats months after initial OP exposures. In agreement with these studies, DFP-treated rats exhibited mean immobility time of 81.6 plus or minus 5.5 seconds that was significantly higher than immobility time of 30.2 plus or minus 4.5 seconds noted in saline-treated age-matched control rats, confirming presence of depression-like symptoms following repeated low-dose DFP exposures. Subsequent behavior studies were conducted only on DFP-exposed rats receiving either saline or drug KET/MIM treatment. Effect of KET on locomotor activity were first assessed using the OFT. The lowest KET dose, 3, 5, and 10 milligram, were not associated with significant locomotor retardation at 1 hour after the KET injection, but the higher 20 mg or 20 milligrams of KET dose was associated with significant motor and coordination. And there is a chart here that shows it. I'm going to drop this link on my page so you guys can actually read through this and look up these words yourself. It's insane. So, antidepressant-like effect of KET and MIM in DFP rats. Effective KET treatment on locomotor activity. No significant differences in the distance traveled were observed on the open field test between DFP or KET-treated rats when tested at 1 hour post-injection. Dose-dependent effect of KET on a forced swim test. KET treatment 5 and 10 milligrams produced significant reductions in immobility times compared to DFP rats when tested at 1 hour post-injection. And time course of KET antidepressant effect, KET treatment 10 milligrams produced a significant decrease in immobility time in the FST compared to saline-treated DFP rats at 1 hour and 24 hours, but not at 1 week post-injection. And then effect of MIM treatment on FST, MIM 10 milligrams produced a significant reduction in mobility on FST when tested at 1 hour, but not at 24 hours post-injection. KET treatment in DEP-treated rats produced a dose-dependent reduction in FST immobility time at 1 hour post-injection compared to saline-treated DFP rats. Ketamine at 5 milligrams and 10 milligrams dose produced significant reductions in FST immobility time. KET at 3 milligrams, while producing some reductions in mobility time, was not significantly different from immobility time exhibited by DFP-treated rats. On the FST, ketamine-treated rats exhibited excessive floating and motor incoordination, risking sinking behavior, and therefore further testing was terminated. Thus, ketamine 10 milligrams produced maximal reductions in immobility time without significant motor toxicities, and this dose was used in further studies. Interestingly, the antidepressant-like effect of ketamine 10 milligram persisted at 24-hour post-injection. Some reductions, although non-significant, were observed even at 72 hours post-ketamine therapy, and by 1 week, the antidepressant-like effect and single ketamine injection was lost. So, in essence, what they're saying in all this medical jargon is there's promise with ketamine. And what I was explaining earlier, which was kind of the way it was explained to me yesterday, if you do, for example, the three that I was talking about, you do like Monday, Wednesday, Friday of 1 week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of the second week, I believe the result is long lasting after that. So you end up with, like, for example, an additional 3 weeks of feeling good. You don't have the depressive symptoms, you don't have the suicide-like symptoms when you're on this treatment. The question that I had tried to ask while I was there, and I really couldn't get an answer for, the doctor had to take off before I got a chance to ask the question, was, is the ketamine treatment something that we would be on long term? And he kind of addressed it early on in his presentation, but it was a little unclear as to how long you would be on this treatment, or how feasible it is to be on this treatment for a lifetime. I did some kind of open-ended research on ketamine itself, and it does seem to have some pretty nasty side effects as far as attacking your bladder and causing issues in that route. And there's other some other side effects as well. But I believe the amount that you're being exposed to plays a part in that. So that's something that you'd have to talk to your doctor about. I'm sure they would be more knowledgeable in that area. But that's pretty much all I have. I was excited about sharing that. I had planned a different podcast today, but when I heard about this, I thought this would be more relevant. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed me stumbling through all these big medical terms. There's a whole lot more here, and like I said, I'm going to place this link on the Gulf War page, on my Gulf War page at Gulf War Vets, so that you can find it there. I'm also going to place another link on the page that talks about Gulf War veterans and the Gulf War illness itself. It's from the publichealth.va.gov page, and at the bottom there's six different boxes that I think are beneficial to everybody that you should definitely be familiar with if you aren't already. The first one is related illnesses, Gulf War exposures, research studies, benefits, provider resources, and publications and reports. This is an area that you don't want to just come and look at once. This is something that if you are suffering from Gulf War illness, or you are assisting somebody who's suffering from Gulf War illness, you need to be spending some time here on this page. You need to be here frequently because it gets updated every once in a while. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on. The related illnesses box, it goes into the medically unexplained illnesses, and infectious diseases and stuff. The Gulf War exposures, that's your oil well fires, your pesticides, the vaccinations. Oddly enough, they do list vaccinations here. So there is some recognition that the vaccinations may have played a part in it. And if you've heard some earlier interviews of mine, you would have heard somebody that I spoke to that's actually vaccine injured. If you haven't, I would go back and listen to that. There are quite a few veterans out there with issues like that, and some of them didn't even deploy. But anyway, and then on the research studies box, that's where you can find out about Gulf War related research, obviously, and what's being tested and what's working and what's not. The benefits page, obviously, if you are fighting the VA for your benefits, this is a good location for you to spend a lot of time in. The registry exam is something you'd want to do right away. If you haven't done that, that's the beginning of your process. And keeping up with your healthcare. You can click on the healthcare link and go through and read about that. I'm not going to go too much into detail on any of these. It's just something that you should be aware of. And I may even forward this on to the president of Minnesota Veterans as well, in case this isn't on their site. That way you can also go to Minnesota Veterans website and have access to this link. They're kind of a one-stop shop for a lot of support for veterans. So if you need anything or you need to talk to somebody, it's a good place to go or a good place to start to actually get a person. I know you don't always get a person when you're trying to reach the VA. The last one is publications and reports I mentioned. This is just a resource area, media materials. There's more than just Gulf War stuff here. It's quite a bit more entailed. So definitely spend some time in these blocks. I will post this link at Gulf War Vets, and as I said, I'll forward it to Minnesota Veterans as well. That way you have access to this. If there's anything else that I can do, you're more than welcome to reach out to me. I'm always glad to help out and assist in any way I can. I do respond to everybody who messages me. I try to respond within 24 hours. Sometimes that doesn't happen, but for the most part, I do. I hope everybody has a great rest of your week, and I appreciate all your support. And don't forget to elbow bump a vet.